This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Written by Arlie Russell Hochschild. Performed by Suzanne Torin.
Preface. When I began this research 5 years ago, I was becoming alarmed at the increasingly hostile split in our nation between two political camps. To many on the left, the Republican Party and Fox News seemed intent on dismantling much of the federal government, cutting help to the poor, and increasing the power and money of an already powerful and rich top 1%. To many on the right, that government itself was a power-amassing elite, creating bogus causes to increase its control and handing out easy money in return for loyal Democratic votes. Since that time, both parties have split their seams, and Donald Trump has burst onto the scene, quickening the pulse of American political life. I had some understanding of the liberal left camp, I thought, but what was happening on the right? Most people who ask this question come at it from a political perspective. And while I have my views, too, as a sociologist, I had a keen interest in how life feels to people on the right. That is, in the emotion that underlies politics. To understand their emotions, I had to imagine myself into their shoes. Trying this, I came upon their deep story, a narrative as felt. The subject of politics was a big departure for me, but my close-up approach was not. In a previous book, The Second Shift, I focused on the abiding question of how parents guard care and time for life at home when both work outside it. I found myself sitting on kitchen floors in the homes of working families, watching to see which parent a child called for, which parent answered the phone, the relative gratitude each partner felt to the other. In search of a family-friendly workplace, I hung out in parking lots outside industrial plants and corporate headquarters to observe the hour when weary workers headed home, the time bind, and explored workers' fantasies of the vacations they'd go on, the guitar they would learn, if only they had time. I conducted in-depth interviews with Filipina nannies, global woman. And in a small village in Gujarat, India, interviewed commercial surrogate mothers who carry the genetic babies of Western clients, the outsourced self. All this work led me to believe strongly in paid parental leave for working parents of newborns and adoptive babies, a policy offered by all the world's major industrial nations except the United States. Now that most American children live in homes in which all adults work, the idea of paid parental leave seemed to me highly welcome, humane, overdue. But this ideal has come slam up against a new truth. Many on the right oppose the very idea of government help for working families. In fact, apart from the military, they don't want much government at all. Other ideals, strengthening environmental protection, averting global warming, ending homelessness, face the same firmly closed door. If we want government help in achieving any of these goals, I realized, we need to understand those who see government more as problem than solution. And so it was that I began my journey to the heart of the American right. Already in the late 1960s, sensing a split in American culture, my husband Adam and I set off to live for a month in King's Kauai Garden Apartments, complete with jungle bird and beast sound effects piped into a common jungle-decorated patio, in Santa Ana, California, to try to get to know members of the John Birch Society, an earlier right-wing precursor to the Tea Party. We attended meetings of the society and talked to as many people as we could. Many members we met had grown up in small towns in the Midwest and felt deeply disoriented in California's anomic suburbs, an unease they transformed into a belief that American society was at risk of being taken over by communists. Looking around, we could well understand why they felt taken over. In a few years, entire orange groves had disappeared into parking lots and shopping malls, a case of wildly unplanned urban sprawl. We too felt taken over by something, but it wasn't communism. I have lived most of my life in the progressive camp, but in recent years I began to want to better understand those on the right. How did they come to hold their views? Could we make common cause on some issues? These questions led me to drive one day from plant to plant in the bleak industrial outskirts of Lake Charles, Louisiana, with Sharon Galicia, a warm, petite, white, single mother, a blonde beauty, on her rounds selling medical insurance. Unfazed by a deafening buzzsaw cutting vast sheets of steel, she bantered with workmen, their protective gear lifted to their brows, their arms folded. She was an appealing and persuasive fast talker. "What if you have an accident, can't pay bills, or can't wait a month for your insurance to kick in? We insure you within 24 hours. As they reached for a pen to sign up, Sharon talked to them about deer hunting, about the amount of alligator meat in boudin, a beloved spicy Louisiana sausage, and about the latest LSU Tigers game. As her story unfolded while we drove between plants, Sharon recounted how her dad, a taciturn plant worker, had divorced her troubled mother, remarried, and moved into a trailer a 30-minute drive away, all without telling her brother or her. I left alive with questions. What had happened to her father? How had the fate of his marriage affected her as a little girl, then as a wife, and now as a single mother? What were the lives of the young men she talked to? Why was this bright, thoughtful, determined young woman, one who could have benefited from paid parental leave, an enthusiastic member of the Tea Party, to whom the idea was unthinkable? I thanked Sharon directly, of course, for allowing me to follow her in her rounds, but later, in my mind, I thanked her again for her gift of trust and outreach. And after a while it occurred to me that the kind of connection she offered me was more precious than I'd first imagined. It built the scaffolding of an empathy bridge. We, on both sides, wrongly imagine that empathy with the other side brings an end to clear-headed analysis, when in truth, it's on the other side of that bridge that the most important analysis can begin. The English language doesn't give us many words to describe the feeling of reaching out to someone from another world, and of having that interest welcomed. Something of its own kind, mutual, is created. What a gift. Gratitude, awe, appreciation. For me, all those words apply, and I don't know which to use. But I think we need a special word, and should hold a place of honor for it, so as to restore what might be a missing key on the English-speaking world's cultural piano. Our polarization, and the increasing reality that we simply don't know each other, makes it too easy to settle for dislike and contempt. I first experienced reaching out and being reached out to as the child of a Foreign Service officer. In my child's mind, I had been given a personal mission, parallel to my father's, to befriend the people of all the foreign countries my father's job took us to. I was instructed to reach out, I imagined, to people who spoke, dressed, walked, looked, and worshipped differently than we did. Had my father really asked me to do this? I don't think so. Why do it? I had no idea. That understanding came later. Curiously, I felt that same gratitude for connection when, many decades later, I drove from plant to plant with Sharon, and when I talked with the many others I've met in the course of researching this book. I felt I was in a foreign country again. Only this time, it was my own. Part 1. The Great Paradox. 1. Traveling to the Heart. Along the clay road, Mike's red truck cuts slowly between tall rows of sugarcane, sassy silvery tassels waving in the October sun, extending across an alluvial plain as far as the eye can see. We are on the grounds of the Armelise Plantation, as it was once called. A few miles west lies the mighty Mississippi River, pressing the soils and waste of the Midwest southward, past New Orleans, into the Gulf of Mexico. "We used to walk barefoot between the rows," Mike says. A tall, kindly white man of 64, Mike removes his sunglasses to study an area of the sugarcane and comes to a near stop. He points his arm out the truck window to the far left. "My grandma would have lived over there." Moving his arm rightward, he adds, "My great-uncle Tane's carpentry shop was about there." Nearby was the home of another great-uncle, Henry, a mechanic nicknamed Pook. A man called Pirogue ran the blacksmith shop where Mike and a friend hunted scraps of metal that shone through his boyhood eyes like gold. His grandfather, Bill, oversaw the cane fields. Miss Ernestine's, Mike continued, was to the side of that. A slim black woman, hair in a white bandana, Mike recalls. "She loved to cook raccoon and opossum for her gumbo, and we brought her what we had from a day's hunt, and shoepick fish, too. I can hear her calling out the window when her husband couldn't start their car, 'Something's ailing that car.'" Then Mike points to what he remembers of a dirt driveway to his own childhood home. "It was a shotgun house," he muses. "You could aim right through it, but it held the nine of us okay." The house had been renovated slave quarters on the Armelise Plantation, and Mike's father had been a plumber who serviced homes on and off it. Looking out the window of the truck, it's clear that Mike and I see different things. Mike sees a busy, beloved, bygone world. I see a field of green. We pull over, climb down, and walk into the nearest row. Mike cuts us a stalk, head and tails it, and whittles two sticks of the fibrous sugarcane. We chew it and suck the sweetness from it. Back in the truck, Mike continues his reverie about the tiny, bygone settlement of Banderville, finally dismantled only in the 1970s. About three-quarters had been black and a quarter white, and they had lived, as he recalls it, in close, unequal harmony. Mike had passed his boyhood in an era of sugar, cotton, and mule-drawn plows, and his adulthood in the era of oil. As a teenager earning money over the summer for college, he had laid wooden boards through mosquito-infested bayous to set up oil drill platforms. As a grown, college-educated man, he had trained himself as an estimator, calculating the size, strength, and cost of materials needed to construct large platforms that held oil drilling rigs in the Gulf, and to create the giant white spherical tanks that stored vast quantities of chemicals and oil. "When I was a kid, you stuck a thumb out by the side of the road, you got a ride. Or if you had a car, you gave a ride. If someone was hungry, you fed him. You had community. You know what's undercut all that?" He pauses. "Big government." We climb back in his red truck, take a swig of water, he has brought plastic bottles for us both, and continue edging forward through the cane as our conversation shifts to politics. "Most folks around here are Cajun, Catholic, conservative," he explains, adding with gusto, "I'm for the Tea Party." I'd first seen Mike Schaff months earlier, standing at the microphone at an environmental rally on the steps of the Louisiana State Capitol in Baton Rouge, his voice cracking with emotion. He had been a victim of one of the strangest, literally earth-shaking environmental disasters in the nation, one that robbed him of his home and community. A sinkhole that devoured 100-foot-tall trees and turned 40 acres of swamp upside down, as I shall describe. That raised a big question in my mind. The disaster had been caused by a lightly regulated drilling company. But, as a Tea Party advocate, Mike had hailed government deregulation of all sorts, as well as drastic cuts in government spending, including that for environmental protection. How could he be both near tears to recall his lost home and also call for a world stripped of most government beyond the military and hurricane relief? I was puzzled. I sensed a wall between us. Empathy walls. You might say I'd come to Louisiana with an interest in walls. Not visible physical walls, such as those separating Catholics from Protestants in Belfast, Americans from Mexicans on the Texas border, or, once, residents of East and West Berlin. It was empathy walls that interested me. An empathy wall is an obstacle to deep understanding of another person, one that can make us feel indifferent or even hostile to those who hold different beliefs or whose childhood is rooted in different circumstances. In a period of political tumult, we grasp for quick certainties. We shoehorn new information into ways we already think. We settle for knowing our opposite numbers from the outside. But is it possible, without changing our beliefs, to know others from the inside, to see reality through their eyes, to understand the links between life, feeling, and politics, that is, to cross the empathy wall? I thought it was. I'd asked Mike Schaff to show me where he'd grown up, because I wanted to understand, if I could, how he saw the world. By way of introduction, I'd told him, "I'm from Berkeley, California, a sociologist, and I'm trying to understand the deepening divide in our country. So I'm trying to get out of my political bubble and get to know people in yours." Mike nodded at the word divide, then quipped, "Berkeley? So y'all must be communist." He grinned as if to say, "We Cajuns can laugh. Hope you can." He wasn't making it hard. A tall, strongly built man in tan-rimmed glasses, he spoke succinctly, in a low, near mumble, and was given both to soulful, sometimes self-deprecating reflection and stalwart Facebook proclamations. Explaining his background, he said, "My mom was Cajun and my dad was German. We Cajuns call ourselves coonasses. So since I was half Cajun and half German, my mom called me half-ass." We laughed. Mike was one of seven children his dad had raised on a plumber's wage. "We didn't know we were poor," he said, a refrain I would hear often among those I came to know on the far right, speaking of their own or their parents' childhoods. Mike had an engineer's eye, a sportsman's love of fish and game, and a naturalist's ear for the call of a tree frog. I didn't know any members of the Tea Party, not to really talk to, and he didn't know many people like me. "I'm pro-life, pro-gun, pro-freedom to live our own lives as we see fit, so long as we don't hurt others. And I'm anti-big government," Mike said. "Our government is way too big, too greedy, too incompetent, too bought, and it's not ours anymore. We need to get back to our local communities, like we had at Amelie's. Honestly, we'd be better off." Not only have the country's two main political parties split further apart on such issues, but political feeling also runs deeper than it did in the past. In 1960, when a survey asked American adults whether it would disturb them if their child married a member of the other political party, no more than 5% of either party answered yes. But in 2010, 33% of Democrats and 40% of Republicans answered yes. In fact, partyism, as some call it, now beats race as the source of divisive prejudice. When Americans moved in the past, they left in search of better jobs, cheaper housing, or milder weather. But according to The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded Americans is Tearing Us Apart, by Bill Bishop and Robert G. Cushing, when people move today, it is more often to live near others who share their views. People are segregating themselves into different, emotionally toned enclaves. Anger here, hopefulness and trust there. A group of libertarian Texans have bought land in the Salt Flats east of El Paso, named it Paulville, and reserved it for enthusiastic, freedom-loving followers of Ron Paul. And the more that people confine themselves to like-minded company, the more extreme their views become. According to a 2014 Pew study of over 10,000 Americans, the most politically engaged on each side see those in the other party not just as wrong, but as so misguided that they threaten the nation's well-being. Compared to the past, each side also increasingly gets its news from its own television channel. The right from Fox News, the left from MSNBC. And so the divide widens. We live in what The New Yorker has called the Tea Party era. Some 350,000 people are active members. But, according to another Pew poll, some 20% of Americans, 45 million people, support it. And the divide cuts through a striking variety of issues. 90% of Democrats believe in the human role in climate change, surveys find, compared with 59% of moderate Republicans, 38% of conservative Republicans, and only 29% of Tea Party advocates. In fact, politics is the single biggest factor determining views on climate change. This split has widened because the right has moved right, not because the left has moved left. Republican presidents Eisenhower, Nixon, and Ford all supported the Equal Rights Amendment. In 1960, the GOP platform embraced free collective bargaining between management and labor. Republicans boasted of extending the minimum wage to several million more workers and strengthening the unemployment insurance system and extension of its benefits. Under Dwight Eisenhower, top earners were taxed at 91%. In 2015, it was 40%. Planned Parenthood has come under serious attack from nearly all Republican presidential candidates running in 2016. Yet a founder of the organization was Peggy Goldwater, wife of the 1968 conservative Republican candidate for president, Barry Goldwater. General Eisenhower called for massive investment in infrastructure. And now, nearly all congressional Republicans see such a thing as frightening government overreach. Ronald Reagan raised the national debt and favored gun control, and now the Republican state legislature of Texas authorizes citizens to open carry loaded guns into churches and banks. Conservatives of yesterday seem moderate or liberal today. The far right now calls for cuts in entire segments of the federal government. The departments of education, energy, commerce, and interior, for example. In January 2015, 58 House Republicans voted to abolish the Internal Revenue Service. Some Republican congressional candidates call for abolishing all public schools. In March 2015, the Republican-dominated U.S. Senate voted 51-49 in support of an amendment to a budget resolution to sell or give away all non-military federal lands other than national monuments and national parks. This would include forests, wildlife refuges, and wilderness areas. In 1970, not a single U.S. senator opposed the Clean Air Act. Joined by 95 Republican congressmen, Senator David Vitter of Louisiana, one of the most polluted states in the Union, has called for the end of the Environmental Protection Agency. And the Tea Party's turn away from government may signal a broader trend. During the Depression of the 1930s, Americans turned to the federal government for aid in their economic recovery. But in response to the Great Recession of 2008, a majority of Americans turned away from it. As the political divide widens and opinions harden, the stakes have grown vastly higher. Neither ordinary citizens nor leaders are talking much across the aisle, damaging the surprisingly delicate process of governance itself. The United States has been divided before, of course, during the Civil War. A difference in belief led to some 750,000 deaths. During the stormy 1960s, too, clashes arose over the war in Vietnam, civil rights, and women's rights. But in the end, a healthy democracy depends on a collective capacity to hash things out. And to get there, we need to figure out what's going on, especially on the more rapidly shifting and ever stronger right. The Great Paradox. Inspired by Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, I began my 5-year journey to the heart of the American right, carrying with me, as if it were a backpack, a great paradox. Back in 2004, when Frank's book appeared, there was a paradox underlying the right-left split. Since then, the split has become a gulf. Across the country, red states are poorer and have more teen mothers, more divorce, worse health, more obesity, more trauma-related deaths, more low birth weight babies, and lower school enrollment. On average, people in red states die 5 years earlier than people in blue states. Indeed, the gap in life expectancy between Louisiana, 75.7, and Connecticut, 80.8, is the same as that between the United States and Nicaragua. Red states suffer more in another highly important but little-known way, one that speaks to the very biological self-interest in health and life: industrial pollution. Louisiana is an extreme example of this paradox. The Measure of America, a report of the Social Science Research Council, ranks every state in the United States on its human development. Each rank is based on life expectancy, school enrollment, educational degree attainment, and median personal earnings. Out of the 50 states, Louisiana ranked 49th, and in overall health, ranked last. According to the 2015 National Report Card, Louisiana ranked 48th out of 50 in 8th grade reading, and 49th out of 50 in 8th grade math. Only 8 out of 10 Louisianans have graduated from high school, and only 7% have graduate or professional degrees. According to the Kids Count data book, compiled by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, Louisiana ranked 49th out of 50 states for child well-being. And the problem transcends race. An average black in Maryland lives 4 years longer, earns twice as much, and is twice as likely to have a college degree as a black in Louisiana. And whites in Louisiana are worse off than whites in Maryland, or anywhere else outside Mississippi. Louisiana has suffered many environmental problems, too. There are nearly 400 miles of low, flat, subsiding coastline, and the state loses a football field-size patch of wetland every hour. It is threatened by rising sea levels and severe hurricanes, which the world's top scientists connect to climate change. Given such an array of challenges, one might expect people to welcome federal help. In truth, a very large proportion of the yearly budgets of red states, in the case of Louisiana, 44%, do come from federal funds. $2,400 is given by the federal government per Louisianan per year. But Mike Schaff doesn't welcome that federal money and doubts the science of climate change.
"I'll worry about global warming in 50 years," he says.
Mike loves his state and he loves the outdoor life, but instead of looking to government, like others in the Tea Party, he turns to the free market. Mike's mother had voted for the Louisiana Democrat Ed Edwards because he was Cajun, and for Jack Kennedy because he was Catholic. Democrat wasn't a bad word when he was growing up, but it is now. Mike had long worked for a small business and advocates a free market for businesses of all sizes. And from this, yet another paradox seemed to unfold. Many Tea Party advocates work in or run small businesses. Yet the politicians they support back laws that consolidate the monopoly power of the very largest companies that are poised to swallow up smaller ones. Small farmers voting with Monsanto, corner drugstore owners voting with Walmart, the local bookstore owner voting with Amazon. If I were a small business owner, I would welcome lower company taxes, sure, but strengthening the monopolies that could force me out of business? I didn't get it. Wrapped around these puzzles was a bigger one. How can a system both create pain and deflect blame for that pain? In 2008, reckless and woefully underregulated Wall Street investors led many to lose savings, homes, jobs, and hope. Yet years later, under the banner of a free market, many within the growing small-town right defend Wall Street against government overregulation. What could be going on? Maybe the best way to find out, I thought, was to reverse the big sort, to leave my blue neighborhood and state, enter a red state, and try to scale the empathy wall. My neighbors and friends on my side of the wall are more or less like me. They have BA degrees or more and read the New York Times daily. They eat organic food, recycle their garbage, and take BART, the public rail system, when they can. Most have grown up on one or the other coast. Some are churchgoers, but many call themselves spiritual and don't regularly go to church. Many work in public or nonprofit sector jobs and are as puzzled by all this as I am. When I started out, I had no close friend who'd been born in the South, only one who worked in oil, and none in the Tea Party. In his New York Times essay, "Who Turned My Blue State Red?", Alec McGillis offers an intriguing answer to the great paradox. People in red states who need Medicaid and food stamps welcome them, but don't vote, he argues. While those a little higher on the class ladder, white conservatives, don't need them and do vote against public dollars for the poor. This two notches up thesis gives us part of the answer, but not most. For one thing, as I was to discover, the affluent who vote against government services use them anyway. Virtually every Tea Party advocate I interviewed for this book has personally benefited from a major government service or has close family who have. Several had disabled elderly parents lacking private long-term care insurance and had them declared indigent in order to enable them to receive Medicaid. Another man, whose wife suffered a severely disabling disease and whose care would have bankrupted him, lovingly divorced her to make her eligible for Medicaid. The able-bodied brother of a disapproving sister, both Tea Party, received SNAP benefits. The brother of another put in for unemployment during hunting season. Most said, "Since it's there, why not use it?" But many were ashamed and asked me to dissociate their identity from such an act. which I've done. But shame didn't stop those who disapproved of public services from using them. McGillis suggests that voters really act in their self-interest. But do they? The two notches up idea doesn't explain why red state voters who are not themselves billionaires opposed taxing billionaires, the money from which might help expand a local library or add swings to a local park. The best way to test the McGillis idea, I figured, is to pick out a problem that affluent voters in poor red states do have, and to show they don't want government help for that either. In other words, the two-notch-up voter may say, "Let's cut welfare to the poor because I'm not poor." Or, "Never mind improving public schools, my kid goes to a private one." Although no one I spoke to talked like this. But they do themselves face other problems the government could help with, which brings me to the keyhole issue in this book, environmental pollution. Through a close-up view of this issue, I reasoned, I could uncover the wider perspective that drove people's responses to it and to much else. To begin with, I wanted to go to the geographic heart of the right, the South. Nearly all the recent growth of the right has occurred below the Mason-Dixon line, an area that, encompassing the original Confederate states, accounts for a third of the U.S. population. In the last two decades, the South has also grown by 14%. Between 1952 and 2000, among high school-educated whites in the South, there has been a 20% increase in Republican voters. And among college-educated whites, the increase was higher still. In the nation as a whole, whites have moved right. Between 1972 and 2014, they shifted from composing 41% of all Democrats to 24%, and from 24% of Republicans to 27%. White independents also grew during this time, most of them leaning right. So if I wanted to understand the right, I would need to get to know the white South. But where in the South should I go? In the 2012 election, in the nation as a whole, 39% of white voters voted for Barack Obama. In the South, 29% did. And in Louisiana, it was 14%, a smaller proportion than in the South as a whole. According to one 2011 poll, half of Louisianans support the Tea Party. Next to South Carolina, Louisiana also held the highest proportion of state representatives in the U.S. House of Representatives Tea Party caucus. As luck would have it, I had one contact in Louisiana, Sally Capel, the mother-in-law of a former graduate student of mine. It was Sally who would introduce me to the white South and, through a friend, to the right within it. A Lake Charles-based artist, Sally was a progressive Democrat who, in the 2016 primary, favored Bernie Sanders. Sally's very dear friend and a world-traveling flight attendant from Opelousas, Louisiana, Shirley Slack, was an enthusiast for the Tea Party and Donald Trump. Both women had joined sororities, although different ones, at Louisiana State University. Each had married, had three children, lived in homes walking distance apart in Lake Charles, and had keys to each other's houses. Each loved the other's children. Shirley knew Sally's parents and even consulted Sally's mother when the two got to fussing too much. They exchanged birthday and Christmas gifts, and jointly scoured the newspaper for notices of upcoming cultural events they had, when they were neighbors in Lake Charles, attended together. One day when I was staying as Shirley's overnight guest in Opelousas, I noticed a watercolor picture hanging on the guest room wall, which Sally had painted as a gift for Shirley's 11-year-old daughter, who aspired to become a ballerina. With one pointed toe on a pudgy pastel cloud, the other lifted high, The ballerina's head was encircled by yellow, star-like butterflies. It was a loving picture of a child's dream, one that came true. Both women followed the news on TV. Sally through MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, and Shirley via Fox News' Charles Krauthammer. And each talked these different reports over with a like-minded husband. The two women talk by phone two or three times a week, and their grown children keep in touch, partly across the same political divide. While this book is not about the personal lives of these two women, it couldn't have been written without them both. And I believe that their friendship models what our country itself needs to forge, the capacity to connect across difference. To begin with, I read what other thinkers had to say about the rise of the right. At one extreme, some argued that a band of the very rich, wanting to guard their money, had hired movement entrepreneurs to create an astroturf grassroots following. In The Billionaire's Tea Party, for example, the Australian filmmaker, Tacky Oldham, had found that homegrown citizen groups challenging climate change were funded by oil companies, and argued that populist anti-government rage was orchestrated by corporate strategy. Others argued that extremely rich people had stirred the movement to life without arguing that grassroots support was fake. The New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer describes the strategy of billionaire oil baron brothers Charles and David Koch to direct $889 million to help right-wing candidates and causes in 2016 alone. To bring about social change, Charles Koch says, requires a strategy that uses vertically and horizontally integrated planning, from idea creation to policy development to education to grassroots organizations to lobbying to litigation to political action. It was like a vast, sprawling company that owns the forest, the pulp mill, the publishing house, and pays authors to write slanted books. Such a political company could wield astonishing influence, particularly in the years after Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission, the 2010 Supreme Court decision permitting unlimited anonymous corporate gifts to political candidates. This influence is indeed at work. Just 158 rich families contributed nearly half of the $176 million given to candidates in the first phase of the presidential election of 2016, $138 million to Republicans, and $20 million to Democrats. Through Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers have circulated a pledge in Congress to curb the authority of the EPA. Armalee's Plantation, where Mike Schaff was born, and Bayou Corn, where he lived and had hoped to die, were a few miles from a strip of the Mississippi now studded with petrochemical plants, and popularly called, with good reason, Cancer Alley. Was concern about this issue in Mike Schaff's interest? He thought so. No one was paying him to attend local meetings of the Tea Party, nor were they paying his neighbors, many of whom shared his views. In What's the Matter with Kansas, Frank argues that people like Mike are being greatly misled. A rich man's economic agenda is paired with the bait of social issues. Through appeal to abortion bans, gun rights, and school prayer, Mike and his like-minded friends are persuaded to embrace economic policies that hurt them. As Frank writes, vote to stop abortion, receive a rollback in capital gains taxes. Vote to get government off our backs, receive conglomeration and monopoly everywhere from media to meatpacking. Vote to strike a blow against elitism, receive a social order in which wealth is more concentrated than ever before in our lifetimes. His beloved fellow Kansans, Frank argues, are being terribly misled. So, how does it work to be misled? Can we be smart, inquiring, well-informed, and still misled? Mike was highly intelligent, consulted a number of news sources, although his main source was Fox News, and he talked politics endlessly with family, neighbors, and friends. Like me, he also lived in an enclave of like-minded people. Mike didn't think the Koch-funded idea machine was duping him. In fact, Mike wondered whether a Soros-funded machine was duping me. Purchased political influence is real, powerful, and at play, I think. But as an explanation for why any of us believe what we do, duping and the presumption of gullibility is too simple an idea. Our home enclaves often reflect special cultures of governance, tying politics to geography. This is the thesis of Colin Woodard's American Nations. Rural areas in the Midwest, the South, and Alaska lean right, while large cities, New England and the two coasts, lean left, he notes. Bound by a tradition of small-town governance and oriented toward Europe, New Englanders tend to believe in good government for the common good. Appalachians and Texans tend to be freedom-loving government minimalists. Tracing their roots to a caste system, whites in Dixie states treasure local control and resist federal power, linked as that is to the defeat 150 years ago of the South by the North. Resistance to federal taxation, the historian Robin Einhorn notes, also originated in the South. Regional traditions are real, of course, but less immutable than Woodard suggests. And while the far right is strongest in the South, most of its members make up a demographic: white, middle to low income, older, married, Christian, that spans the whole nation. Others point to the moral values of the right. In The Righteous Mind, for example, Jonathan Haidt argues, unlike Frank, that people are not misled, but instead vote in their self-interest, one based on cultural values. While right and left both value caring and fairness, he notes, they place different priorities on obedience to authority, the right, and originality, the left, for example. Surely this is true, but a person can hold a set of values calmly, or in a state of fury that brings a whole new party into being. What makes the difference between the two? Theda Scotchpole and Vanessa Williamson rightly argue that it is a unique coalescence of circumstances, predisposing factors and precipitating ones. Primary among the latter were the Great Recession of 2008 and government efforts to forestall it, the presidency of Barack Obama, and Fox News. While all these works greatly helped me, I found one thing missing in them all: a full understanding of emotion in politics. What, I wanted to know, do people want to feel? What do they think they should or shouldn't feel? And what do they feel about a range of issues? When we listen to a political leader, we don't simply hear words. We listen predisposed to want to feel certain things. Some broad emotional ideals are shared across the political spectrum, but others are not. Some feel proud of a "give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses" Statue of Liberty America, while others yearn to feel proud of a constitution-abiding, work-your-own-way-up America. At play are feeling rules, left ones and right ones. The right seeks release from liberal notions of what they should feel, happy for the gay newlywed, sad at the plight of the Syrian refugee, unresentful about paying taxes. The left sees prejudice. Such rules challenge the emotional core of right-wing belief. And it is to this core that a freewheeling candidate such as the billionaire entrepreneur Donald Trump, Republican candidate for president in 2016, can appeal, saying as he gazes upon throngs of supporters, "See all the passion." We can approach that core I came to see through what I call a deep story, a story that feels as if it were true. As though I were seeing through Alice's looking glass, the deep story was to lead me to focus on a site of long-simmering social conflict, one ignored by both the Occupy Wall Street left, who were looking to the 1 and the 99% within the private realm as a site of class conflict, and by the anti-government right, who think of differences of class and race as matters of personal character. The deep story was to take me to the shoulds and shouldn'ts of feeling, to the management of feeling, and to the core feelings stirred by charismatic leaders. And, as we shall see, everyone has a deep story. Visits and follow-arounds. But first, the people. I originally based myself in Lake Charles, a town of 74,000 in southwest Louisiana, some 30 miles north of the Gulf of Mexico. Half were white, half black, many of Cajun ancestry. 3% were foreign-born. 23% of residents had a BA, and the median household income was $36,000 per year. Seated in Calcasieu Parish, Louisiana's French heritage led to the use of parishes instead of counties, Lake Charles hosts 75 festivals in the surrounding area, and its Mardi Gras Museum claims the largest collection of Mardi Gras costumes in the world. It attracts tourists to its three large casinos and workers to its rapidly expanding petrochemical industry. Once there, I scouted out members of the far right in a number of ways. To begin with, Sally Capel and Shirley Slack helped set up four focus groups, two made up of liberals, two of Tea Party advocates. Each group met in Sally's kitchen, and I followed up the Tea Party sessions with interviews of individual Tea Party advocates, sometimes interviewing their spouses and parents, too. I say interview because I asked people to sign a sheet describing my purpose before we talked, but at the end of 2 or 3 hours, they often said it was very nice visiting with you. And in truth, these sessions often turned into a mix of interview and visit. An accountant I met through a Tea Party focus group invited me to a series of monthly luncheon meetings of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, playfully quipping, "Maybe we'll change your mind." There I discovered a well-attended, highly organized gathering of white, middle-aged professional women and a special table of teenagers in red T-shirts. At each luncheon, I met new people at my table and made dates to follow up with them, often meeting their families and sometimes their neighbors. I was invited to visit two private Christian schools and to attend Baptist, Pentecostal, and Catholic church services and activities, including a 40s-plus Pentecostal gumbo cook-off. One woman at the Republican Women's Luncheon was a Pentecostal pastor's wife, who introduced me to many in her church and invited me to join her and her friends in a game of Rook, a 57-card game of so-called missionary poker, which provides evangelical players a happy alternative to card games associated with gambling. I met a man whose great-uncle had been the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, a reason his grandfather had moved to another town, and met a white member of the Tea Party and strong Baptist woman who had adopted an African-American baby and a South American child. I also followed the campaign trails of a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate and his Tea Party rival, which took me to the Acadian Village Pig Roast in Lafayette, a rice festival and boat parade in New Iberia, a Get Out the Vote event in Crowley, and a union meet and greet in Rain. At each whistle stop, I chatted with my neighbors. A marine biologist and environmental activist, Mike Tritico, a political independent and son of a furniture store owner, told me of right-wing friends who vehemently opposed his activism. A tall man of 70 with a teacherly manner and encyclopedic grasp of local industry, he was seen as a recluse by some. He lived in a disheveled cabin in the woods of Longville. As a saint by others, and as a thorn in their side by state regulatory officials. I asked if I could tag along with him and meet his adversaries. Mike was game. Over 5 years, I accumulated 4,690 pages of transcripts, based on interviews with a core of 40 Tea Party advocates and 20 others from various walks of life, teachers, social workers, lawyers, and government officials, who enlarged my perspective on my core group. From within that core group, I selected a small number who illustrated particular patterns especially well. With their permission, I followed them around, asking to see where they were born, attended school and church, shopped, and had fun with them, and tried to get a feel for the influences on them. While all supported the Tea Party, they varied greatly among themselves. Some went to church 3 times a week, others not at all. Some had 7 guns, others 3, of which some were behind glass, others in a bedside drawer. They differed in how they saw poverty. One man said, "I asked the security guy at our local grocery store what sort of stuff gets stolen from the store. He said it was mainly rice, beans, and baby food." That tells you something. Others thought such reports were exaggerated. They differed in their fears. One man told me he had bought a second-hand medical book at Goodwill in case the economy crashed and burned and he had to set his own broken arm. Another stocked provisions in case we all have to be self-sufficient, and he had neighbors doing the same. Most were less alarmed. My core group differed in their suspicion of President Obama, too, and in their denigration of him. The Facebook page of one Tea Party advocate showed mugshots of President Obama, front and side, a nameplate below his image, while another showed him in public housing. Most were angry, afraid, some in mourning for real losses, but in their emotional complexion, too, they differed widely among themselves. For more on my research, see Appendix A. I was definitely not in Berkeley, California. For one thing, the occasional turn of phrase was different. As fast as a duck can eat a June bug. Up to my ass in alligators. One man referred to unadorned, yep, nope, speech as talking Yankee. Churches grand and humble studded the landscape. In some towns, one a block. 3 aisles in Lake Charles's largest bookstore were dedicated to Bibles of different colors, shapes, and print sizes, and to leather-bound Bible study notebooks. Some restaurants advertised Lenten season specials, appealing to the Catholic French Creole and Cajun residents. Certain absences also reminded me I was not at home. No New York Times at the newsstand. Almost no organic produce in grocery stores or farmers markets. No foreign films in movie houses. Few small cars. Fewer petite sizes in clothing stores. Fewer pedestrians speaking foreign languages into cell phones. Indeed, fewer pedestrians. There were fewer yellow Labradors and more pit bulls and bulldogs. Forget bicycle lanes, color-coded recycling bins, or solar panels on roofs. In some cafes, virtually everything on the menu was fried. There were no questions before meals about gluten-free entrees, and dinner generally began with prayer. Farther east from Lake Charles and along the strip of petrochemical companies lining the lower Mississippi, I saw quite a few signs for personal injury lawyers. Just call Chuck. In the absence of the talismans of my world, and in the presence of theirs, I came to realize that the Tea Party was not so much an official political group as a culture, a way of seeing and feeling about a place and its people. I compared the student activity groups registered at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, the alma mater of some I talked with those at the University of California, Berkeley, where I have long taught. At Louisiana State, a campus of some 30,000 had some 375 student groups, I found student chapters of the Oilfield Christian Fellowship, the Agribusiness Club, the Air Waste Management Association, the Society of Petrophysics and Well Log Analysts, and a Wargaming and Role-Playing Society, WARS, none of which had analogs at UC Berkeley. UC Berkeley, with 37,000 students and 1,000 student organizations, listed Amnesty International and the Anti-Trafficking Coalition, Building Sustainability at Cal, Environmental Science Student Association, Global Student Embassy at Berkeley to promote grassroots environmental cooperation, groups with no analogs at LSU. Mike Schaff had graduated from Louisiana State University in Monroe and had joined the Chess Club, Circle K, Kiwanis, and a military fraternity called Scabbard and Blade. With an enrollment of 25,000, his university featured some 150 student groups. One group, Cupcakes for a Cause, raised money to help women veterans. Another group, the ULM Fishing Team, held monthly tournaments. At Northeastern Louisiana State, student clubs included College Republicans and Young Americans for Liberty, but not College Democrats. Driving around Lake Charles, I noticed "Don't Tread on Me" bumper stickers on the back of a few pickup trucks, showing a coiled rattlesnake with an extended tongue. The symbol, first created by a colonial Revolutionary War general in 1775, has been adopted nationally by the Tea Party. Although it came down in 2011, I saw an enormous "Where's the Birth Certificate" sign on Interstate 49 between Lafayette and Opelousas, publicly questioning President Obama's birthplace. At the edge of a used truck lot on Route 171 between Longville and DeRidder, an hour's drive north of Lake Charles, a placard on the side of a wooden hut ominously proclaimed it the Obama Smokehouse. Reminders of the racial divide were everywhere. In the Westlake Cemetery, for example, a roadway divided the graves of whites and blacks. The grass around the whites' graves had been recently trimmed, while that around the black graves had not. Another example was a granite statue of a young Confederate soldier in front of the old Calcasieu Parish courthouse, above a plaque thanking those who defended the South. No parallel sites commemorated slave heroes or victims of lynching. On my 2016 visit to Lake Charles, I noticed a small flag of the early Confederacy, 13 stars in the upper left, and red, white, and red bands to the right, at the base of this monument. Three of the five parishes of southwest Louisiana, not to mention the Jefferson Davis Bank and Freeway, are named after Confederate officials of the Civil War, and the state has 90 Confederate monuments, some unveiled as recently as 2010. Only 15 years ago, a cross was burned near a trailer in Longville, where one of my guides, Mike Tritico, and friends of his I came to know, lived. The last known burned cross in the state. Six men were charged and sentenced by federal prosecutors. Race seemed everywhere in the physical surroundings, but almost nowhere in spontaneous, direct talk. A keyhole issue. I wanted to get up close. The best way to do that, I thought, was to come to know one group of people in one place, focusing on a single issue. This issue was not a case, as mentioned earlier, of well-to-do voters voting down government measures they themselves didn't need. Everyone I talked to wanted a clean environment. But in Louisiana, the great paradox was staring me in the face. Great pollution and great resistance to regulating polluters. If I could truly enter the minds and hearts of people on the far right on the issue of the water they drink, the animals they hunt, the lakes they swim in, the streams they fish in, the air they breathe, I could get to know them up close. Through their views on this keyhole issue, how much, if at all, should government regulate industrial polluters, I hope to learn about the right's perspective on a wider range of issues. I could learn about how, emotionally speaking, politics works in us all. As an oil state with a record of going light on regulation, Louisiana has suffered decades of severe environmental damage. During the time I was doing my research, the fracking boom also hit Lake Charles, and the town rapidly became the center of a stunning $84 billion planned investment in southwest Louisiana, one of the biggest investments in American industry. Lake Charles had become ground zero for production of American petrochemicals. I brought industrial growth into view through interviews with public officials, the mayor of nearby Westlake and the head of the Southwest Louisiana Task Force for Growth and Opportunity, which had just been given the assignment of planning for the arrival of 18,000 workers to be housed in man camps. 13,000 of these workers were from out of state, including Filipino pipe fitters. While in Lake Charles, I stayed at Aunt Ruby's bed and breakfast. By the edge of the bathtub in my quarters, I discovered a moisturizing body wash, on the back side of which were listed in small print the ingredients: petroleum, ammonium laureth sulfate, sodium lauroamphoacetate, ammonium lauryl sulfate, lauric acid, sodium chloride, hydroxypropyltammonium chloride. The same ingredients, it occurred to me, could be found in the plastic in my sunglasses, my watch band, my computer, my moisturizer. Lake Charles produced the airplane fuel that brought me there, and the gasoline I was getting around on, and much of this was produced by companies close by. To prepare for my journey, I reread Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, a Tea Party Bible lauded by the conservative radio pundit Rush Limbaugh and former Fox News television commentator Glenn Beck. Rand describes serving the needy as a monstrous idea. Charity, she says, is bad. Greed is good. If Ayn Rand appealed to them, I imagined, they're probably pretty selfish, tough, cold people, and I prepared for the worst. But I was thankful to discover many warm, open people who were deeply charitable to those around them, including an older, white, liberal stranger writing a book. Given its liberal reputation, I worried about telling people I taught at UC Berkeley. I secretly hoped my Louisiana acquaintances would respectfully recall its 72 Nobel laureates, its proud academic standing. But no. When I told one man that I lived in Berkeley, he immediately replied, "Oh, you got hippies." Another had seen a Fox News report of Berkeley students protesting fee hikes. They had linked themselves together with iron chains and stood before TV cameras on the edge of the roof of a campus building. If one fell, so would they all, which was, I guess, their point. "Did you say Berkeley students need an A average to get in?" someone asked me, incredulous. "The chain thing seems pretty stupid to me." From across the table at a meeting of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, Madonna Massey, a gospel singer, declared that she loved Rush Limbaugh. In the past, I'd found Limbaugh harshly opinionated, and incurious and offended, I'd routinely switched the dial. But now, I told Madonna, "I'd love to talk about what you love about him." When we sat down a week later to sweet teas at a local Starbucks, I asked Madonna what she loved about Limbaugh.
"His criticism of feminazis, you know, feminists, women who want to be equal to men."
I absorbed that for a moment. Then she asked what I thought, and after I answered, she remarked,
"But you're nice."
From there, we went through Limbaugh's epithets: commie libs, environmental wackos. Finally, we came to Madonna's basic feeling that Limbaugh was defending her against insults she felt liberals were lobbing at her.
"Oh, liberals think that Bible-believing Southerners are ignorant, backward, rednecks, losers. They think we're racist, sexist, homophobic, and maybe fat."
Her grandfather had struggled as a desperately poor Arkansas sharecropper. She was a gifted singer, beloved by a large congregation, a graduate of a 2-year Bible college, and a caring mother of two. In this moment, I began to recognize the power of blue state catcalls taunting red state residents. Limbaugh was a firewall against liberal insults thrown at her and her ancestors, she felt. Was the right-wing media making them up to stoke hatred, I wondered? Or were there enough blue state insults to go around? The next time I saw Madonna, she was interested to know if it had been hard for me to hear what she'd said. I told her it wasn't. "I do that too sometimes," she said. "Try to get myself out of the way to see what another person feels." As I walked with Mike Schaff through the sugarcane fields of the old Armelies plantation, or sat with Madonna in the Living Way Pentecostal Church, I was discovering good people at the center of this great paradox. How could kindly Madonna oppose government help for the poor? How could a warm, bright, thoughtful man like Mike Schaff, a victim of corporate malfeasance and wanton destruction, aim so much of his fire at the federal government? How could a state that is one of the most vulnerable to volatile weather be a center of climate denial? So, curious to find out, I began this journey into the heart of the right. 2. One thing good. There he is, seated on his wooden front porch overlooking a trim yard in suburban DeRidder, Louisiana, watching for my car. He rises from his chair, waving with one arm and steadying himself on his walker with the other. A large-chested, 6'3" man with a gray crew cut and jet blue eyes, Lee Sherman, age 82, beams me a welcoming smile. A player for the Dallas Texans football team, later renamed the Kansas City Chiefs, for 2 years, an honoree in Who's Who of American Motorsports, a NASCAR racer who drove 200 miles an hour in a neck brace and fire suit, and the proud purchaser of a water ski boat once owned by TV's Wonder Woman, Lee shakes my hand, apologizing. "I'm sorry to be on this thing," he points to his walker, "and not take you through the house properly." He doesn't feel like his old self, he says, but accepts his feeble legs good-naturedly. Given his dangerous work at Pittsburgh Plate Glass, he is happy to be alive. "All my co-workers from back then are dead. Most died young," he tells me as he slowly leads me through a tidy home toward the dining room table, on which he has set coffee cups, coffee, cookies, and a large photograph album. Driving north from Lake Charles through southwest Louisiana to DeRidder, I had passed a miscellany of gas stations, family dollar stores, payday loan offices, diners, and lush, green rice fields. Crayfish were sometimes cultivated in the wet canals between rows of rice, flat on all sides to the horizon. Some 200 miles west of DeRidder, on land bordering Texas, lay a vast pine wilderness, once a no man's land where the legendary outlaws